fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip.
When you're a stranger, faces look ugly. When you're alone, women seem wicked. When you're unwanted, streets are uneven. When you're down, when you're strange.
History buffs and researchers travel the world in search of the strangest and most interesting stories about our past, investigating reports of mysterious hidden tunnels, mythical creatures, outlandish beliefs, and curious customs. But what they often find is that the most bizarre historical records come from right here in our own backyard. Wisconsin is home to plenty of strange historical traditions, as well as many myths that have persisted throughout the years, even when the facts tell us otherwise. Filled with tales of legendary pranksters, con men, folk heroes, and mystery, today's program just might change the way you view the state's good old days. But what makes Wisconsin's bizarre history so intriguing? And what can it tell us about our present and future? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Today, we take a look at Wisconsin's weird history, looking back decades, even centuries, at the many tales that persist throughout the years, not all of which are true. During today's program, we invite you to join the conversation and ask your own questions by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Ben Clark is the archivist and historian at the Marathon County Historical Society, helping manage their collections while answering questions from residents and offering a range of educational programs. One of the organization's recent programs explored the myths, misconceptions, and mistakes from local history in Marathon County, much of what we'll be discussing here today. Ben, welcome back to Route 51. Ben, I think you are muted, so you'll want to unmute yourself there. Jody Kiffmeyer is an archivist with the Chippewa Valley Museum and has lived in the Chippewa Valley for most of her life. She became intrigued by the area's culture and past during a fourth-grade trip to the Pioneer Village in Barron County. And the rest is history. Jody, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Carrie Bladorn is the director and curator at Pioneer Park Historical Complex in Rhinelander, as well as the resident Hodag historian. He also offers a regular history segment on WXPR and writes history articles for the New North magazine in town. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here talking about quirky Wisconsin history.
I love it. Jody, you know exactly when you caught the history bug, so to speak. So why is it that local history is so interesting to so many people? What makes us want to know so much about our past?
Well, I think sometimes you're talking about people that either your parents knew or you might even have known. There's a realness to it that if you can visit the places easily on a weekend or something, that just adds like a whole new dimension to being able to study history.
Sure. Ben, you recently did a series of talks on weird local history in Wausau. What is the strangest thing you dug up when you were researching this?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that is, we kind of expected was maybe not quite accurate. You know, the legends kind of make it seem to be a little bit more than it, you know, it actually was. But certainly, you know, we came across, you know, for example, there was a traveling doctor who turned out not to be just a local guy, but somebody who was all over the state of Wisconsin, you know, came up from Illinois and, you know, kind of a quack doctor kind of figure. He would advertise in the paper with flashy claims of being able to solve everything. And, you know, certainly not what we expected to see from that period.
Well, Jody, what's the strangest thing you learned about your area as a historian?
I would say I'm going to bring up the incident like when I was in fourth grade that when I went to the Pioneer Village Museum and they have the literal county seat there at the museum. It's a log that was hollowed out and that's where the county records used to be kept. But there was a county seat war that went on between the towns of Barron and Rice Lake. And somebody from Barron actually smuggled the county records from Rice Lake to Barron over in the middle of the night on a January really cold night so that Barron could have the county seat. And eventually they did win the war. So that's what really intrigued me about history. That's what caught my attention the first time. You can still see that. They still have the county seat at the Pioneer Village Museum. So.
Well, Carrie, you're in Rhinelander. I have to believe that the weirdest thing about Rhinelander is the Hodag. What's the story behind the Hodag?
The Hodag was created by a timber cruiser, land surveyor, and map maker from the Rhinelander area, Eugene Simeon Shepherd. And since his legend was created, Rhinelander's become the home of the Hodag, which is the official cryptid of Wisconsin. And Rhinelander might even be the state capital of mythological creatures as well. So everybody knows about the Hodag, but Gene Shepherd was also known for many number of pranks and stories that he told. He was just a phenomenal storyteller, and hope we can chat about some of those today.
Absolutely. But, I mean, why did he create the Hodag? What was the whole reason behind it?
He had learned the art of tall tale telling in lumber camps as he was growing up, working as a surveyor as a young man. And he just became so good at storytelling that it was just a knack that he had for, you know, telling these crazy stories. And people were intrigued and entertained by his stories. And toward the end of the logging era in the Northwoods, he wanted to come up with some way to captivate audiences and get them to come up to the Northwoods to enjoy the wonderful, beautiful things that we all love. And in that spawned the Hodag.
So interesting. Ben, what about other cities in the area? Are there any other mythical creatures or beasts that are found in other cities throughout the area?
Certainly there are a lot of stories that get passed down from that era. The early settlement of the lumberjacks, they would kind of, you know, they might be in a place like Wausau or Rhinelander or whatever, but they would go out into the woods. So they would often kind of, like, there are a lot of stories that were, particularly in, like, the early 20th century, start to get written down and sort of documenting these the lore of the lumberjacks. And some of these are very, you know, clearly they're you know, pulling the new guy's leg sort of thing, you know, beasts that are apparently, like, we don't know what he looks like. He's just very shy, but he's definitely out there. Everybody knows that they exist. But I think that's the Squidgicum Squee. I think that's what the name of that one is.
The Squidgic, wait.
Squidgicum Squee?
That, yeah. That's quite a name.
So that was, you know, an example of that sort of, like, you kind of can see the veteran lumberjacks kind of pulling the leg of the new guy, saying, you know, watch out for that. And then they ranged from lumbering was a very dangerous job. So a lot of the other, when a tree would break and a limb would come down and crush somebody, well, that's got to be because there's a beast up there hiding. You know, that's the splinter cat. And they just sit up there and they wait for stuff to happen. And then they that's how they catch their prey. So it's kind of a mix of things. And these all kind of get it. Like, it's kind of certainly Rhinelander and the Hodag is very unique in that it's very much rooted in a specific place. You know, that is, you know, part and parcel with who they are, and they've adopted that. A lot of the other stories are just kind of generalized, but, you know, are part of the wider fabric of that lumbering heritage.
Jody, what about Eau Claire? Are there any mythical beasts or those kinds of legends in your area that you're aware of?
Not so much that are particular to Eau Claire as far as the mythical beasts go. Eau Claire does have a pretty interesting history with animals. There is an elephant that's buried here in Eau Claire. And yes, it was 1901 that a circus came to Eau Claire and there was a storm and hit the circus with lightning. And one of the elephants was killed. And so what do? You bury it. And they buried the elephant at the circus grounds. And then just a year later, they were trying to make a driving park there where the circus grounds were. And they dug up the elephant's body. And apparently it smelled really bad. It smelled terrible. So they reburied it, you know, outside of town. But of course, as the town grows, outside of town now becomes the middle of town. And somebody's building or digging a basement for a house. And here's the elephant again. So This elephant has been in Eau Claire in several different places. I don't think anybody knows where it is now. Probably will turn into some folklore.
I would imagine so. Well, Carrie, one name consistently comes up when researching Rhinelander's history. You brought him up just a moment ago. Gene Shepherd, quite the character. It feels like he was really legendary in your area. Tell us more about him.
So many people know Gene Shepherd for his creation of the Hodag. It's literally been woven into the fabric of Rhinelanders' heritage and history, so much so that next week we are celebrating Hodag Heritage Days with the Hodag Heritage Festival on May 21st at Pioneer Park. But there are other things about Gene Shepherd's life. If you take the deeper dive, you learn that, you know, Hodag was just one of the things that he talked about and one of the legends that he had made up. And a couple of those other ones were he had a pet muskie, and he was able at his resort on Ballard Lake, which was near Star Lake, Wisconsin, to conjure up this muskie on demand. So visitors to the resort, you know, he would tell them that he had this pet muskie out in the lake, and he would go to the bank of the lake and do a funny whistle whereby this muskie would jump out of the water on command. And of course that was pretty strange, especially for visitors to the Northwoods to see this trained muskie. Another thing that he did was he put vials of moss together that he had discovered deep in the wetland areas of the Northwoods, and he called it perfumed moss. And he sold these vials of moss to people that came from all over the Midwest and all over the country. And what he actually did was collected moss and put perfume on the moss. But that's all you have to do to share that with people. And then they think that the Northwoods of Wisconsin is full of this, you know, perfumed moss that grows everywhere. And then he also created other creatures aside from the Hodag. One of his most famous stories of other non-Hodag-related creatures was an insect called a beesquito, which was part bee, part mosquito. As if bees and mosquitoes weren't bad enough in the Northwoods, this one had a bloodsucker on one end and a stinger on the other end, and Gene was reported as saying it could get you either coming or going. And that harkens back to the stories that Ben had talked about, just this lumberjack tall tale telling history that existed throughout lumber camps across the country. And a few other animals that were talked about in the Northwoods were the sidehill gouger, which lived on the sides of hills and only traveled in one direction. Therefore, its legs were shorter on one side than they were on the other side. There's another creature called a gilly galoo, which was a bird that also tended to live on the hillside. And because of this nesting that it did on the hillside, it laid square eggs so that the eggs wouldn't roll down the hill. So just a few more of the amazing creatures that lived in the Northwoods.
I love the creative thinking behind some of these stories. It's just so amusing. Ben, are there any other notable eccentric personalities you can think of in Wausau's history?
There certainly have been people that you could say were eccentric. You know, Neil Brown comes to mind, kind of eccentric for his time, for example. He was a lawyer here. And I guess we can talk more about him later. He's the one who had the world famous flapjacks, because he was a lawyer here. He was a businessman, but he was one of those people who had a cottage out on the river out in the Northwoods, and he would bring his friends up from Chicago and show them how to go fly fishing and make them flapjacks. And so, you know, at a time when that was really, you know, you didn't just drive up for the weekend and spend time at the cottage. So he was kind of that. You know, he was a lawyer, he was a judge, he was, you know, a businessman, but then he also would just kind of go out hunting, around the turn of the century. That's kind of a eccentric thing to be doing.
Sure.
And certainly had a reputation then for, you know, entertaining people.
You're listening to Ben Clark, Carrie Bladorn, and Jody Kiffmeyer on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on Wisconsin's weird history. Coming up, the truth about those long-rumored underground Prohibition-era tunnels in Wausau and other communities, more political scandals, and we'll answer your questions, too, when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Jody Kiffmeyer, Carrie Bladorn, and Ben Clark are our guests today on Route 51 for a look back at Wisconsin's bizarre history and the stories of yesterday. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can join us by phone at 800-780-9742. So, Ben, is there really a network of tunnels beneath Wausau's downtown area? I've heard this for years. People who've claimed they've been in them, they've seen them. Are they real?
So that falls in the category of maybe, but probably not. I think there is this sort of romance, this sort of idea that people are drawn to about tunnels, especially up here in, you know, parts of Wisconsin where it gets cold, and the idea, I mean, even if they were just like, you know, some of them I've heard explanations of just being like, well, the people that lived across the street from the church just didn't want to walk outside in the cold, so they had a tunnel dug underneath the ground. But a lot of the as far as I can tell, and again, I've also heard stories here and there that I've never been able to really track down for sure. But there was a sort of gentleman's club called the Wausau Club here in town. Today it's the modern art museum there. It's been repurposed, but back in the day, it was like the place where everybody hung out. And a little further on the block, there was the Wausau Pilot, the newspaper, had a press there. And that's now Shepherd and Scheller. So it's a sporting goods store. And a couple years ago, probably a while ago now, they were doing some renovation in the basement, and they found, you know, they took down a wall, and there was just a door that led to the direction of where the Wausau Club would be in their basement. And it's kind of speculated that there must have been a tunnel, because, you know, there's some evidence to show that. Now, that may have been, you know, again, it might have been just been the editor of the Pilot didn't want to walk outside during the winter. It was just convenient just to go down through the tunnel. But of course, that doesn't stop speculation that, of course, this has to have been prohibition, because prohibition tunnels are a thing. And certainly the Wausau Club, you know, there might have been some stuff happening there. But I also think that, you know, it was founded on the ideals of no dancing and no alcohol. And a lot of the guys who were, you know, big in that era would have been teetotalers anyway.
Very interesting.
It's hard to know. Again, tunnels, who knows what's under the ground? As far as I know, that's not actually something that exists. But, you know, we can't say for sure.
You're crushing me, Ben. You're crushing me.
Sorry. Yeah.
Jody, I've heard Eau Claire also has tunnels. Is that true?
I don't know so much about tunnels, but we do have caves along the riverbank. And again, a lot of that has to do with breweries. And, you know, the breweries would dig caves or explode caves, however they were going to do it to store their beer. And I imagine they were hiding it too during Prohibition. But one gal, actually, her name was Maud Phillips. She sometimes went by the name of Violet Lee. And she moved her family into one of the caves along the Eau Claire River in Eau Claire, and was kind of known as a different character. She was into free love and free thinking and had various affairs. And she just, you know, she was kind of on outs with people. But when she moved into that cave, you know, of course, a lot of people didn't like that, didn't like having this gal living in a cave with her kids and who knows what else. And so they actually took her to court and got her. She was called insane, actually. And, you know, who would live in this cave if they weren't insane? So,
sure. Good point, right?
Yes. So she ended up spending, I believe she spent the rest of her life in a mental hospital.
Oh, wow.
Just because she wanted to live in a cave.
Wow. Well, okay. Carrie, I'm curious about any tunnels in Rhinelander. Are you aware of any, or really any kind of prohibition type lore that you can think of?
So Jody and Ben hit on a couple of important points in regards to Wisconsin's history. Wisconsin, you know, well known for its brewing history, and also the Northwoods of Wisconsin, well known for its mobster history. You got the likes of John Dillinger and other mobsters that reportedly came up to the Northwoods to hide out during Prohibition. Excuse me. And along with breweries and mobsters, you always get stories of tunnels. You'd think that every community in Wisconsin, and particularly in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, had a speakeasy or some amount of a tunnel system, if you listen to people talk about it. There is a famous tale here in Rhinelander about a tunnel that existed between the Rhinelander Brewing Company and the owner of the brewery, Otto Hilgerman's house, which is kitty corner from the brewery. The brewery is long gone. The house is still there. And if you ever bring up tunnels in Rhinelander, you will hear about this tunnel, this particular tunnel. The evidence suggests maybe not something quite as grand as a tunnel. When I think of a tunnel, I think about a doorway. You walk into the tunnel, you traverse, you know, underground to a different location. It was said in the blueprints of the Hilgerman house and the brewery that the Hilgerman house was heated by a steam conduit that went from the steam furnace at the brewery. Thereby, the house didn't have to supply its own heat system. It came directly from the brewery. And I think over the years, particularly through Prohibition, when the brewery shut down, there was this idea that the brewery was still brewing beer and they had to smuggle it out some way, somehow. And slowly that steam conduit turned into a tunnel that was used to smuggle beer and Lord knows what else. In the later years, there was a gentleman that grew up in that house who spent time, a lot of time there, and he had never discovered any source of any tunnel. And I believe in the 70s, when they dug up the street between the old brewery and the home, you know, people in the neighborhood came out in spades to see if they were going to dig up some evidence of this tunnel. And unfortunately, they never did. Although that didn't stop in later years, the staff at the winery, that's what became of the brewery, it turned into the Von Steele Winery. Those staff members were requested to kind of perpetuate this tunnel story. And it doesn't really matter how much evidence comes to light about these certain stories, particularly surrounding tunnels. People just love tunnels and they love to talk about them. And, you know, no matter what type of evidence I can drum up, that tunnel story just has a life of its own.
People do love those tunnel stories, that's for sure. The number to call if you have questions for our guests, 800-780-9742. You can also email ideas at wrwpr.org. Geez, Ben, I wanted to talk to you about the mounds at Marathon Park. There's a lot of rumor going around about what's underneath those mounds and whether they're actually some kind of burial ground. Anyone who's been to Marathon Park will know exactly what I'm talking about. They're very visible there. What's the true story behind those mounds?
Yeah, so the Marathon Park is a... And it was the fairgrounds originally. So, I mean, they still have the fair there every year. But originally when it was basically established, they just had the fair. It was 80 acres of just land that wasn't super well used outside of the fair. And so actually what they ended up leasing it to was I guess that would be the far west side of the fairgrounds was actually given to the German shooting club, the Schutz in the Rhine. And so they had a little clubhouse there and, you know, the German immigrants that were a big part of this community, they showed up and they were happy to continue the, you know, that was one of the first sports in this community. You had horse racing and you have target shooting. And so they wanted a place that they could safely do this. Of course, back then Marathon Park is out, way outside of town. It's not actually within the city limits. So that was a place that they had a little clubhouse and they had actually a backstop where their targets, you know, so the bullets wouldn't keep going. And it's actually that is the remains, you know, if you ever go back in Marathon Park on that western side, kind of back where the camp or that, you know, kind of behind where the grandstands are and that sort of stuff on that side, you might still find these mounds. And that's actually what those were. Those are the remains of the backstop. There were Native Americans here, certainly, but that was not the accounts of those don't exist before the Germans show up.
Okay. We talked about logging a little bit earlier in the program, and I know it's so central to the economies of many of our communities, historically speaking. And every logging camp has some tall tales. You referred to those a little bit earlier, Ben. Carrie, I'm curious what kinds of stories were popular at the logging camps in the Northwoods.
Yeah, I had mentioned a couple more of the creatures outside of the Hodag that were developed in logging camps. But one of my favorite stories that was told in logging camps was a story called The Round River Drive. I know Eau Claire has a rich history with Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox. And it seems like every logging community has some story about Paul Bunyan, who allegedly was based on a real lumberjack, a French-Canadian lumberjack named Paul Bongine, who purportedly had logging camps all over the place and many of them at the same time. There's a story about Paul Bunyan having a logging camp in the Lake Tomahawk area, which is just north of Rhinelander. And Gene Shepard, lo and behold, had wrote a book called Paul Bunyan, His Camp and Wife. And one of the stories that he tells in that book, The Round River Drive, is concerning a river drive that Paul Bunyan had taken, where in the springtime they dumped all the logs from the landing into the river to float them down to the mill town. And after several days of the river drive and floating these logs down the river, they passed the same camp that they left. And they thought that was awfully strange. So not wanting to think too hard about it, they continued on down the river until a few days later they came upon their same camp again. And this just gets, you know, more and more bizarre. And eventually they decided to offload the logs back at camp, considering that this river didn't go anywhere, didn't go to any logging town, just was a river that went in a circle, the Round River.
Is there an actual Round River?
I would assume there actually is a river named the Round River, but I do not believe that it flows in one continuous circle.
Okay, good to know. Jody, what are some of the logging camp tales that you've heard from your area?
This one was from back in like the early 1900s. There was a newspaper article in the Chippewa Falls paper, and some of the men in a lumber camp up near Winter had reported that it was in January, very cold, and in the middle of the night, someone had come in bare feet, no shoes and no socks, and had come from north of the camp. And you know, they could see the footprints come in from the north and then wandered around and made circles around the buildings in the logging camp and then left to the west. And so this is, of course, lots of snow, very cold in the middle of the night. What is this? What are these footprints from, this human footprint with no shoes? And I imagine they made some stories out of that. I've never heard them, but I imagine that there were some pretty good stories that came out of that, some kind of a Bigfoot maybe or a Yeti. You know, you do get those stories up there about the Bigfoot in that area, too.
Sure. I'd like to ask you about cemeteries, too. Ben, cemeteries and their purpose have really evolved over the years. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So it certainly from the early days of, you know, cemeteries were just a place to put the remains of you know, the deceased. They really weren't sort of that hallowed ground in many, especially, you know, in the early years of a lot of the early lumbering communities that we've been talking about. You know, it's just kind of, you need to have them someplace. And as time goes on, we start to kind of really venerate these. These are places to go to be in the presence of your you know, the past loved ones. And they, you know, we start to have, you know, like almost like a garden type thing. You know, we had nice, like, and originally, you know, you would have, people would get together and they would have like a picnic at the cemetery. It wouldn't necessarily have been like a kind of creepy, you know, it doesn't have that, you know, connotation that it kind of does today, for some people, I guess. And, yeah, as time goes on, we start to see, like, for example, in Wausau, we have Pine Grove Cemetery, which is the, you know, the big cemetery off Grand Avenue. And, you know, originally that was just sort of cutover land, and they made a point of replanting trees and making sure that it, you know, over the course of the years that it had, you know, pleasant environment for people to come and mourn or remember. So, yeah.
Carrie, do you have any stories about Rhinelander area cemeteries?
I wish I did. We don't really have many cemetery stories that stick out. The one thing about Rhinelander Cemetery that's kind of well known, at least in the Northwoods, is that football legend John Heisman is buried at Forest Home Cemetery here in Rhinelander. John was not from Rhinelander, but his wife had moved up to the community in their later years. And when he passed away, she asked to have him interred in Rhinelander. So that certainly is a landmark for football lovers around the area to come and stop and check out John Heisman's grave site. Of course, famous for that pose that he does on the Heisman Trophy statue.
Oh, sure. That's a household name for sure. Let's talk a little bit about secret societies. Jody, I know there was a Ku Klux Klan chapter in Barron and Chippewa County that wasn't so secret, but were there other clubs or secret societies in Western Wisconsin that you can think of?
You know, there were the usual ones, the Masons and things like that. I don't know of any particular ones that were special to the Chippewa Valley or to this area. I do know that a lot of times some of the lumber barons would have their own special clubs that they would have, you know, a funny name for it. And then they would get together and, you know, who knows what they did, whatever really rich guys do when they get together and, in secret. So hopefully it was family friendly, but who knows? That's about what I know.
Well, speaking of rich guys who get together in secret, let's talk, Ben, about secret societies in Wausau. Who made up the Wausau group?
Yeah, I don't know if that really qualifies. It's kind of questionable. We don't actually know. I guess I should explain what that is for those people who maybe don't know. The Wausau group was the name given to a group of men who were lumber barons and bankers and, you know, people who had made money but had come here during the boom of the lumber industry. You know, in the late 1800s. And they recognized that, you know, the writing was on the wall for the lumber industry. You know, a lot of the pinery had been, you know, the clear cut a lot of places. It was not going to be as profitable going forward as we get into the new century. And so they decide and they actually sit down and they say, all right, let's figure out a way forward here. And so they're the ones that then decide, you know, rather than pick up and leave and go to the next, you know, the Pacific Northwest or you know, down the South where there's lumbering happening, the next area of lumbering, or just go to like a bigger city. They wanted to stay in Wausau where they had made their homes. And so they reinvest in the community and you know, this is where all the paper companies, we have, you know, three paper companies that were established here within a short time of each other. They created utilities companies, telephone companies, power companies, managing the dam, all that sort of stuff. They had an insurance company that they just, you know, workers' compensation is a thing. I guess we'll have one of these. And that becomes Wausau Insurance, which is, you know, kind of a big name for many years here. So they just kind of, you know, invest in the community at a time when that. And of course, there is an element of this of, you know, who was actually a member. There's kind of a core, like six or seven of them that are in on a lot of these ventures. But then they would just kind of bring in other people. So they don't quite, it's not like they all belong to the same church or they all were in the same, you know, Mason society, although many of them were, you know, at the Presbyterian church or were in the Masons or, you know, had Scottish heritage, but, there's enough variety that it's kind of just a, whoever wants to join in, they would bring them in if they thought they had good business sense and would be good for the community.
You're listening to Wisconsin's Weird History on Route 51 with our guests, Ben Clark, Jody Kiffmeyer, and Carrie Bladorn. What strange stories have you heard about the state's past? You can ask our guests by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Oh, well, you see, we're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward with our guests, Carrie Bladorn, Ben Clark, and Jody Kiffmeyer, as we continue our discussion on the weird history of Wisconsin. Some fact, some fiction. What would you like to know? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. I want to circle back to something that we touched on a little bit earlier in the program, some interesting personalities. We talked about some of the interesting personalities in the area. Jody, I'm thinking about John Till, the doctor. I'd like you to talk about him a little bit.
Sure. Actually, Ben made reference to a doctor of some kind. I wondered if it was the same one, but John Till was an immigrant from Austria. He came to the area around 1898. He was working in a lumber camp in Turtle Lake, and eventually ended up in Somerset, so a little farther west than the actual Chippewa Valley. But a couple from Somerset had stumbled across him, and he had studied folk medicine in Austria. And he had this plaster that he would put on people's backs that was supposed to cure just about anything. And so reportedly this plaster was what the ingredients were, kerosene and something called croton oil, which causes irritation, pain, and swelling on the skin. Some of the people who had their backs treated this way said that their backs came away looking like raw meat. He was just a really interesting character. He would go around in barefoot, dirty clothes. He had two pierced ears with small rings in them. He was just kind of a character that you would wonder, okay, what is this guy doing around here? But he could make some really good money. There were reports that he was treating as many as 150 people a day and making sometimes $20 an hour at that time, which in current dollars would be around $600 an hour.
Wow.
So he was making good money, but he ran afoul of the law and eventually had to go back to Austria. Otherwise, he was going to be in jail. So.
Okay. Carrie, I wanted to ask you about a couple of iconic Northwoods guys, too. Porter Barefoot Dean and Barefoot Charlie. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, it seems like there's a barefoot trend in the Northwoods.
It sounds like
it. Early eccentric personalities. If you were a little bit off the deep end in the late 1800s, early 1900s, odds are good you probably went barefoot. In the Rhinelander area, there was a gentleman named Ted Lassig who owned the Lassig Dairy Company, and he was known for going barefoot on his milk routes, doing door-to-door bottled milk sales. And then you travel a little further north to the Boulder Junction area, and you find Porter Barefoot Dean, who was a famous Northwoods fishing guide. He was very religious about his use of Rhinelander boats from the Rhinelander Boat Company. And he went barefoot everywhere he went. It said that he went barefoot to the grocery store, barefoot on all his guiding trips. And he guided some of the most famous personalities that visited the Northwoods. And it is even said that he went to church barefoot as well. So at no time would you find him in shoes. And then just a little farther north and west of Boulder Junction, you'll find Land O'Lakes and the famous Barefoot Charlie, who dressed like a Native American in buckskins and owned a tavern called Barefoot Charlie's, a very rustic, log-constructed place that was famous for Barefoot Charlie and his entertaining ways about him.
I'm curious about political scandals in the area, too. Ben, what kinds of political scandals in Wausau have come up in your research over the years?
There certainly always have our political, you know, that's a constant in life, is you're going to have some political scandal. It's strange because a lot of the stuff doesn't seem that important in retrospect. It's you know, a big deal about, you know, the appropriation of money, or I mean, I guess local politics is going to be local politics no matter when you're looking at it. Let's see. I'm trying to think of, there's nothing like that quite hits the weird history that I'm aware of. I guess more recently there was that discussion about the snowball ordinance in Wausau, which is kind of a strange thing, kind of made national headlines. There was basically an ordinance in Wausau that said that you weren't allowed to throw things at people, and they listed explicitly, you know, no sticks, no rocks, and no snowballs.
Yes.
And you know, fast forward a couple decades later, you know, we end up with, well, it's illegal to have a snowball fight in Wausau. So that kind of, we had to, you know, make that right. And a couple years ago, we ended up changing our ordinances so that was okay. And then, you know.
I recall that discussion. And the Wausau Police Department made a hilarious YouTube video of throwing snowballs at the mayor. It was very, very funny. Carrie, I wanted to ask you the same thing. What can you point to in Rhinelander that was, you know, scandalous at the time?
Many people know that Rhinelander has a beautiful courthouse, the Oneida County Courthouse, a gorgeous Tiffany-style glass dome which shines for miles and miles, and it is supposedly one of the most photographed buildings in northern Wisconsin. And when it was first built in 1908, as in many political situations, both local, state, and national, there are always people that are for and against any particular decision. In the late 1800s, it was decided that Rhinelander needed a new courthouse. It was originally a frame building, three-story building, and Rhinelander had had a fire in the early 1900s that burned down half of the north side of town, it being mostly lumber yards. And so the courthouse officials decided that if there was ever a fire, this courthouse was not going to stand up. They needed something to protect the records of the residents of Oneida County. So one of the board members, Arthur Taylor, who was a strong proponent of building a new courthouse, had got together with a group of other board members and they devised a plan to build a new courthouse. Well, there were people that were against this, thinking that, you know, the courthouse they had was just as well and they didn't need a new one. Not to spend a single dime on a new courthouse, I think, was one of the adages. In those days, county board members came to town from all four corners of Oneida County. They either walked, came by horse and carriage, horse and buckboard, or rode their horse to the county seat of Rhinelander. And courthouse meetings were held, county board meetings were held on Sunday mornings. And in the bylaws, they were supposed to start at 9 a.m. But because of the distances these gentlemen traveled, they would often come to town either on Saturday evening or as early as possible on Sunday morning. Well, the meetings tended to start late. They didn't really go by the bylaws. They just waited for all the county board members to show up, and that could be 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, and then they would begin the meeting. So as the time got closer to vote on the building of a new courthouse, Arthur Taylor had told some of his other county board members that were in favor of building a new courthouse, hey, Sunday morning, we are going to start the meeting right at 9 a.m., you know, but maybe keep this a little bit hush-hush. And sure enough, Sunday morning rolled around, and all of those proponents of the courthouse build showed up on time and had the vote, and many of those that were opposed to the courthouse build showed up late and too late to place a vote. So that is how the Oneida County Courthouse got built.
Interesting. Those kinds of conflicts are always fascinating. And Jody, there was a guy in western Wisconsin who really stood up to the lumber companies too, John Dietz. What's the story there?
Yeah, John Dietz was kind of a folk hero. If you were in Wisconsin and actually even in the country, his story went around the country and he brought in, people from all over the country were trying to support him, but he had purchased some property early in the 1900s, and there was a dam on the property. And his understanding was that he owned the dam. The lumber company's understanding, and this was a major lumber company, the Chippewa Lumber and Boom, which was at that time may have been owned by or at least run by Frederick Weyerhaeuser, probably one of the richest men in the country at the time. And so John Dietz has this law or this dam, and he says if the lumber company wants to send their logs through here, they have to pay me a toll. And of course, the lumber company didn't want to do that. There was several standoffs. There was a standoff in 1904 when the sheriff tried to serve a warrant. Another one in 1906. And then in 1910, actually, John Dietz's three children who were in their early 20s were ambushed on their way to town. His daughter was shot and spent quite a while up in the hospital up in Ashland. And then a few days after that, like a week after that, then the sheriff and he brought a posse out and they ended up having a major shootout. The house was just riddled with bullets, but the only person that was killed was a sheriff's deputy. His name was Oscar Hart. And so Dietz was put on trial for the murder of this man. He had a lot of public sentiment in his favor up until, it was in the fall of 1910, I think. He was at a county election or some kind of election and had gotten a fight and had shot another man who was well known in the community. And that's when public sentiment turned on him in the area. But he was bringing in money supporting him from all over the country. He ended up eventually he had a life sentence in prison, but then it was commuted first to 20 years and then he got a full pardon in 1921. So very interesting character, kind of like the hero who stands up to the big guy. And at that time in the country, I think people were really interested in a guy like that.
Sure. I think we could probably do a whole program on like crimes of the, you know, or trials and things like that, because that kind of thing is just fascinating. Ben, there's something I wanted to ask you about with respect to Rib Mountain. There, a long time ago, there was a guy who thought there might be gold in Rib Mountain. What happened with that?
Well, it's kind of interesting because it's not just gold. There's a whole massive thing. Like, people see that and think there's got to be something cool buried underneath there. There was a gentleman who had come here after having some success, finding some gold up in Alaska, and he thought, well, the composition of Rib Mountain is enough that it should be the same thing. So he thought there must be gold here, and as it turns out, that didn't really end up happening. But there are other stories about how, you know, there was newspaper articles around the turn of the century saying it was on fire, and there's, you know, this stuff, and they thought, oh, there has to be a natural gas reserve under Rib Mountain. Or an iron, you know, there's all these stories about there, you know, maybe there's iron, maybe there's uranium. In the end, you know, there's not any of that, but it makes for an interesting story.
Yeah,
you
sure
kind of see the appeal of being like, oh, that thing on the horizon, there's got to be something cool associated with that.
Jody, yeah. I want to ask you about cultural things that were common in the past that aren't now. There was a big to-do in the early 1900s about a girl's hair in Eau Claire. It made national news. What's the story there?
Well, there was a 15-year-old girl. It was in around 1915, and she was in school. And, you know, there are, of course, two different sides to the story. But what both sides agree on is that the principal had a talk with her, and he suggested that she shouldn't be wearing her hair the way she was. And she left school crying because of this, and ended up a bunch of students went on strike. A municipal judge had to come, and, you know, they worked out a compromise. Eventually, the principal was exonerated, and several students were suspended for 6 months through all of this. But yes, it did make national news. The St. Paul Pioneer Press published an editorial that was, supportive of the girl and saying, you know, she should be able to wear her hair the way she wants. She's just an innocent girl. I think kind of the insinuation was that she was trying to, bring attention to herself from the boys.
Sure.
She wasn't supposed to be doing that.
Sure. Well, I mean, things have changed so much. I guess, you know, earlier we talked about why history is so interesting, but why do you think it's important? Carrie, what can history tell us today?
History tells us where we come from, where we've been, and it also tells us where we could go into the future. So it is very important to learn from history and to share history. One thing I try to tell people is that history is not just what's in the books that we can go find at the library. Everybody's mind is full of history, and it's so important to share the history that we have with other people that are interested in it, to preserve that past. The history you have that you've lived is important, and it's worth telling other people about. So if you got something in your mind, some experience that you lived, some strange part of Wisconsin history that you were around for, I encourage people to share that with others.
Ben, I'd like to get your thoughts on that. What's so important about history? Why do we study it, and what makes you want to learn more about it?
Well, I think Carrie did a great job of setting that up. I think that that's absolutely true. The thing that I would add is I think everything has a history. You know, you don't have to be somebody who's studying history or, you know, go out of your way. You can find the history of whatever you're interested in, whatever community you come from, and that can be important.
Thank you so much. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, extending a sincere thanks to our guests, Ben Clark, Carrie Bladorn, and Jody Kiffmeyer. Our producers are Joy Ratchkramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Special music today provided by The Doors, ELO, Etta James, and Warren Zevon. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program as well as our previous programs at wpr.org/route51.
You can also subscribe to our podcast. It's available from your favorite platform. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you'll join in. Until then, we're heading out of town.
Get a big dish of beef chow mein.